We are happy. It feels right and good. The art and skill of meditation rests in understanding how to employ this pleasure as an aid for immersing ourselves more fully, more deeply into the meditation, without turning what is a wholesome, skillful, and powerful aid on the path to enlightenment into a source of craving. Chasing after or clinging to some experience is a sure way to increase your suffering and to cut yourself off from the very meditative states you seek to develop. This is the time to recollect and connect with your intentions, enlisting all the support you have been developing. If we do not know what our intentions are, our actions are liable to be dictated by our feelings and moods, especially when the power and energy of a situation is strong. Let your wholesome intention act as a touchstone. Make it the standard by which you make decisions instead of following after the moment's appeal. The natural tendency to be drawn toward pleasant experiences is deeply ingrained in all of us. But even during the most intense times, when the pleasures enthrall us, we can avoid becoming seduced by them. Gather all the mindfulness and clarity of awareness you are able to access, and rest in the protection of your wholesome intention. When we are clear about our intention, fascinating experiences do not delude or deceive us. We remember that our intention is the liberation pointed to by the Buddha, not to collect one more exciting experience that is only going to come and go like all the others before it. You never have to worry about being too concentrated, as long as that concentration is right concentration. Remember that samadhi, the term we translate as concentration, actually means undistracted. You can never be too undistracted as long as you have an inclusive awareness along with mindfulness and equanimity to the extent necessary for meeting whatever degree of concentration there is. Balancing energy. While you cannot be too concentrated, you can have the wrong kind of concentration or an unbalanced concentration. Energy, or any of the experiences we are talking about that are associated with concentration, can be too strong for us or of a quality that we are not able to handle. After discussing some of the ways unbalanced concentration can manifest, we will examine various approaches for working with them. Anything that can arise in meditation can be worked with. With proper tools, you will learn to navigate all of meditation's ups and downs, meeting whatever happens with confidence and clarity. Strong energies can course through the body and can be associated with pleasure, bliss, or light, or they can be highly unpleasant or agitating. Some meditators may experience loud inner sounds. These experiences can be agreeable and satisfying, or they may become unpleasant or too much for us to handle. These energies can remain localized in one place, or they can move around and permeate the entire body. They can remain at the same intensity, weaken, or grow, and their location and strength can fluctuate in regular cycles or appear sporadically. All of this is dependent upon our individual dispositions, the sensitivities of our nervous systems, and our psychosomatic conditioned patterns. Concentration tends to suppress the hindrances, gladdening our hearts and calming our minds. Unpleasant or challenging thoughts and feelings tend not to come up when our minds are settled. But being concentrated can also have the opposite effect. Concentration tends to permeate and pervade whatever experience is most prominent, so difficult states of mind may become magnified rather than suppressed. As your experiences of concentration become stronger and your mind becomes increasingly focused, the concentration tends to enhance those experiences. A memory or story can become blown up, and because your perception has been altered, you may not be able to tell. The exaggerated version becomes your reality, and you believe it. A student once told me of a time on a meditation retreat when she went looking for something to eat in the community refrigerator, a place where extra food, fruit, bread, cheese, and nut butters, was made available for anyone who got hungry between meals. Just as she opened the refrigerator, she noticed a disapproving look from one of the retreat center staff who happened to walk past. She had gotten into a very quiet, concentrated place, and from that one glance, tumbled into a story that she had done something terrible, had somehow broken the rules by being in that refrigerator, that she was being judged for eating between meals when she should be meditating, and finally, that she was going to be kicked out of the retreat. Nothing came of it, and at the end of the retreat, she asked the person about it. That staff person had no recollection of the incident. An incidental glance of no consequence, but perceived in a certain way, got interpreted and ascribed with a world of meaning. We tend not to notice when our minds go into this kind of proliferation. We can just believe the stories we are making up, imagining the worst possible reasons or motives and the most terrible outcomes, spinning out more stories from the stories without recognizing the process that is going on. We create entire realities and proceed to live in those worlds as if they were real. You can be resting peacefully in meditation when some old, forgotten memory suddenly pops into your mind. Maybe you recall something you did that caused harm to others or pain for yourself, and you are filled with regret, guilt, or shame. And because you are so concentrated, that hurt becomes magnified and fills your consciousness, and you are completely back, reliving that old experience, submerged in the old feelings. Old traumas can be activated in concentrated states, triggering upsetting memories of physical injury or emotional, psychological, or sexual abuse, or patterns of fear, worry, self-judgment, or any parts of your life you deal with regularly can come roaring up, seemingly stronger than ever. Desire or longing in some part of your life, something you struggle with daily, can feel like it is going to overwhelm you. Entering unfamiliar territory. We may enter new territory of consciousness where familiar reference points start to disappear. For many people, this never happens, but for some, deepening concentration can open to altered experiences in which their normal sense of reality begins to break down. We may perceive our body as being composed of energy, vibration, or light, and the border between our inner and outer world may become less obvious. It can be disconcerting to feel the solidity and boundary we are used to experiencing begin to melt. You might sense your body grown to many times normal, perhaps feeling as if it fills the entire room. The feeling can be so real that you are convinced you have actually physically expanded, and you have to open your eyes to see that your body is actually normal size. Through the power of our concentrated mind, we may open to perceptions of impermanence where our body and the external world, everything that had seemed solid and stable, now appears to be in constant flux. You may find yourself on a knife edge between past and future as the present moment dissolves right out from under you. We can become frightened if our perception of impermanence gets ahead of our equanimity. If we find ourselves in terrain with which we are unfamiliar, we may become disoriented. If anything happens that we are unaccustomed to, we may feel shaky or fearful. Though these occurrences do not happen for everyone, any of the experiences associated with concentration can become strong, and we need some skillful means for working with them when they do. Two main approaches. For all of these reasons, we need to be respectful of the potential for anything to happen, and we need to develop our capacity for dealing with whatever might arise. There are two main approaches for dealing with any strong or unfamiliar conditions we may encounter in meditation. We can bring down the intensity of the situation, or we can bring up and strengthen our mindfulness, equanimity, and ability to be present with those experiences. Knowing which approach to take, when to turn toward a situation, and when to change our circumstances or move away, is an art that we can develop with experience. Bringing up ability to be with strong experiences. When the situation is within our capability, but we just do not like what is happening, we have to find a way to wait for it to subside on its own. We need confidence in our ability to learn how to be with things, developing patience and a capacity to hang in there through the turbulent times. Cultivating self-reliance may require some trial and error, but over time and with experience, we know we can trust ourselves. We know we do not have to believe our stories, fears, perceptions, or moods because we recognize that these things come and go. We have seen over and over that every experience we have ever had has passed. And we know the same is true for every experience we are ever going to have. Because we have seen that these things come and go, we know how to be with them all, and we know we will emerge from them in time. One meditator, some days into an intensive retreat, reported having a song suddenly pop into his mind. The song kept looping, repeating over and over, and this went on for 2 days. He pushed against it, struggling to turn it off, but he found that pushing only fed it, giving it energy. After half a day, he was crying for mercy, and finally he gave up, let go, and just waited. After 2 days, it disappeared on its own. Sometimes all we need is simply to identify what is happening, acknowledging if the energy feels strong or edgy, or if it feels like too much. Just by recognizing our experience and how we are relating with what is happening, we are able to summon the resources needed to meet these challenging forces, strengthening mindfulness and resting in the undistracted knowing while the process unfolds. If mindfulness is well established and stability is firm, it does not matter how powerful the samadhi experience is, because we are steady, we are undistracted, and we can take refuge in the mindfulness itself. Mindfulness and equanimity help create the container to hold samadhi experiences. When there is too little of either, we are liable to be pulled out of a balanced presence, but these experiences do not bother us if we can meet them with equanimity and clear awareness. We do not have to do anything with them. When mindfulness is clear and balance is strong, we can perceive that whatever happens is just another experience that arises and passes away without grasping at it or pushing it away. Try bringing in a quality of observing rather than becoming caught up, lost, or identified with the experience. You can notice that there is awareness or mindfulness, and that you can relax back into and rest in the pure knowing of the experience. You are still having the experience, but you are aware of being aware. You know that you know. And that can often be a very strong stabilizing force to help work with what is happening. Resting in the knowing does not mean being a disconnected or detached witness, untouched by what is happening. You are fully in the experience, but in a way that is disentangled and unfettered. Such an untroubled and unburdened abiding can act as the safe container for letting go. You can be more deeply present without agitation and can more fully know, not as a concept, but as directly experienced, that this mental, physical, or emotional phenomenon is just another part of the stream of consciousness that arises and passes away due to its own causes and conditions. Taking refuge in the knowing and in the letting go, we gain access to a clear, quiet strength and fearlessness, enabling us to be present and to let go even more fully. We can be fearless because we know we are protected no matter what happens. We have established a secure footing for venturing forth. Sometimes we are able to be present with whatever is happening, but we are afraid of what might happen next. For many people, fear is highly unpleasant. Noticing that fear is present and how unpleasant it is may be just enough support for us to stay with the experience more fully. I have had very powerful experiences arise while meditating, followed by fear that those experiences were going to keep intensifying. But then I would remember to drop back and rest in awareness as a refuge. From that place, all the experiences could arise and pass away, and whatever happened was not a problem. Bringing down intensity. Along with broadening skills for how to be present with something, we must learn how and when to interrupt the process. If you have tried working with the meditation and it still feels like too much, you may need a break. We need to be respectful of samadhi's power and of our boundaries and capabilities. Being honest about what is happening includes being honest about our ability to relate to what is happening. Use your best judgment on how to proceed, and try not to disparage yourself as a bad meditator, thinking that you should stay with an experience when in reality, dealing with it is beyond your capacity. If your mindful presence or equanimity is not sufficient to meet the concentration, find a way to limit or stop the process. If you are not able to be clear, mindful, steady, and present, you need to acknowledge that fact. You may need to bring down the intensity, smooth the rough edges, or pull out of the meditation entirely. From the beginning days of your meditation, you have been cultivating the ability to direct your awareness by returning over and over to your breathing. Now, use the skills you have developed to redirect your attention away from the intensity and towards something nurturing and sustaining. Try putting your attention to some place in your body that feels steady. Feel your body sitting in the chair, or your bottom or legs pressing on the cushion or bench wherever you are sitting. Feel your arms and legs. Put your attention anywhere you can in your body to help yourself feel more embodied and grounded. If the energy is strong, let it flow out your hands and feet and drain into the ground. Take some calming breaths, breathing in a sense of peace and calm, and breathing out the energy. Or try opening your eyes and looking around to reconnect and get back into the normal world. Perhaps get up and walk around, go outside, or engage in mundane activities, feeling your feet or legs as you move. Try anything like this you can do to be more grounded and get back to your ordinary, everyday reality. And then, when you are ready, if you are ready, you can come back, either in this session or another, back into the practice. In this way, we learn with experience when it is time to bring the energy and intensity down, when it is time to back off and come out of the meditation, and when to stay with it by strengthening the presence of mind and equanimity, the pure mindfulness that enables us to rest more fully with whatever is happening. We want to be respectful and not push ourselves into anything. Sometimes you touch on something and then you pull back, but then you touch it again and pull back over and over until you gain some familiarity, letting mindfulness be your refuge, so that even if something is completely unfamiliar and you do not know what is happening, you can rest at peace in mindful presence.
Chapter 8. Jhana, the culmination of concentration. After embarking on his spiritual quest, leaving home, family, and the comfortable, secure life he had known, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha-to-be, spent the next 6 years engaged in a variety of stringent spiritual practices. You will sometimes see statues and images of a skeletal Buddha, representing the ascetic Gautama, emaciated through years of austerity and self-denial. He almost died before realizing that ascetic practices and self-mortification were dead ends that did not lead to liberation from the human condition. As he had this realization, he remembered a time from his childhood, sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree, watching his father plowing a field, when he spontaneously entered a deep state of samadhi, the first jhana. He was feeling happy, relaxed, and at ease in the beauty of that orchard, and naturally fell into this blissful state of peace and calm. And now, his body wasted and near death, he considered whether the same state of clarity and ease could be the way forward. Realizing that jhana was where the path to enlightenment lay, and that it would be hard to attain that state in an emaciated condition, he began to eat, caring for his body and regaining strength. He then turned his attention in a new direction, to the cultivation of right samadhi, tranquility and insight yoked evenly together in jhana. It is hard to overstate the significance of jhana in the Buddha's path of meditation. Over and over, the Buddha emphasized its importance. He practiced jhana on the night of his enlightenment. He taught jhana to his students. And after his enlightenment, he would sometimes withdraw his mind in jhana. He had developed the ability, the mastery, to access these absorption states whenever he chose. A mind well concentrated is purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, flexible, steady, and attained to imperturbability. Such a mind has a penetrative power for surpassing ordinary awareness. It can perceive reality on whole new levels, and, when turned towards awakening and liberation, can see the subtle places of suffering and the ways we can truly rest in the stream of non-clinging. What is jhana? Jhana is dramatically different from the ordinary daily consciousness in which most of us spend our lives. For many, jhana seems exotic and far away from any experience they can relate to or imagine attaining. But as your practice matures, you can come to know the extent to which meditative consciousness can evolve. If you have ever set an intensive meditation retreat, you see how far your practice can develop in just a few days. Jhana is not only for ascetics living in caves. Real meditators, just like you, have realized the benefits jhana has to offer. Recall that as meditation progresses, the unfolding of undistractedness can diverge, heading either toward increasing disconnection from or toward enhanced awareness of your body and mind. Jhana is the culmination of samadhi that is connected. Jhana is a state of deep calm, undistracted clarity, and enhanced connection with and profound insight into the nature of the body and the mind. Because in jhana your mind is so highly attuned and sensitive, you are opening to perceptions on much more refined levels. You may perceive your body as being made of energy vibrations or light. You become effortlessly aware of subtle thoughts or impulses. At this stage, your body and mind may be calmed to such a high degree there is not a lot of mental and physical activity to experience. But you do not need much to be aware of, since the mind is so sensitive and attuned. Heightened awareness of and connection with the body is both an essential characteristic of jhana and, as we shall see, a way leading to it. Defining jhana. Four jhanas are described in the Buddhist text, comprising progressively subtle changes of increasing calm, clarity, and peace. The four jhanas are not actually four separate discrete states. Each is a marker along a continuum. While some of the attributes of the first jhana drop away as you progress through the stages, others are retained, though they may become smoother and subtler from one jhana to the next. To understand the nature of jhana and how to access and progress through the stages, we will begin by exploring the first jhana. Once we understand the first jhana, what the experience of it is like and how to attain it, we will examine aspects of jhana in general. Then we will come back to the four jhanas in sequence, proceeding from the first jhana through the even subtler stages of concentration, the second, third, and fourth jhanas. The first jhana is described by this formula. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters and abides in the first jhana, which is characterized by rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, and accompanied by thought and examination. Secluded from sensual pleasures means having established supportive conditions for entering the deeper stages of samadhi. We can meditate in any surroundings, but our minds will not settle down easily if we are flooded with a constant stream of sense inputs. To cultivate internal seclusion, we must create the proper environment for it and promote wholesome qualities of our hearts and minds. We need to find a time and place best suited to meditation within the constraints of our life circumstances. All the qualities we have been cultivating throughout the course of our meditation, living ethically in accordance with the precepts, balanced effort, ease and relaxation, and a sense of self-compassion, now come to fruition, arriving to meet us as supporting allies. Through our many encounters with difficulties in meditation, we have learned to set aside sensual desire and craving for pleasure, aversion toward difficult and unpleasant experiences, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. As we near jhana, our mind has become even more quiet and calm. This is called secluded from unwholesome states because as we approach jhana, our mind is so still that the hindrances cannot arise. Factors of the first jhana. The four qualities listed in the definition of the first jhana, rapture, pleasure, thought, and examination, along with a fifth factor identified elsewhere in the source texts, unification of mind, comprise the standard list known as the five jhana factors. All five of these factors are present in the first jhana. The Pali term piti, which is translated here as rapture, is also translated as bliss or joy. It refers to all the various experiences of samadhi we have been discussing throughout this book, which can appear as bliss or pleasant experiences of energy, light, or sound. As we have emphasized, how rapture manifests itself is highly individual. Sukha, translated here as pleasure, sometimes as happiness, refers to these same experiences when they have smoothed out and subside in intensity. Some people have very dramatic experiences of rapture in the first jhana, while for others it is very smooth, even, and calm. The happiness or pleasure of jhana can be thick like honey, or, as the jhana progresses, thin out to be very light and sweet. Thought and examination does not refer to thinking in the ordinary sense that we are used to in everyday life. In the first jhana, some thoughts can arise,
but they are greatly diminished. They are quiet and subtle, and are seen and known as they arise. We are never lost or identified with them. Thought and examination here involve unifying the whole mind, bringing all its capacities, including its thinking capacity, together in undistracted awareness. They include directing and sustaining attention to the meditation object. This kind of mental activity is self-sustaining and self-directing, like a gentle guiding or inclining of the mind. In any of the jhanas, though the undistractedness of mind is unshakable, a slight amount of directing of attention can happen. As factors of jhana, thought and examination entail directing this attention to the meditation object so that the mind can be applied to and sustained on that object. Using stock phrases, as is common in the Pali texts, the jhana definitions are often accompanied by beautiful similes that expand upon and illuminate the meaning. The similes not only complement the description in the definitions, they also explain the way to realize jhana and how to advance through the successive stages. The simile for the first jhana is, "He makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion." Just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and sprinkling it gradually with water kneads it till the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it, and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze, so too a fiku, a monk, makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. In the first jhana, awareness is deeply immersed in and suffused throughout the body, as clearly expressed in the simile. But though you are profoundly connected and intimate with the body, the experience of the body is altered from what is accessible through our ordinary sense perceptions. The sense of solidity may give way to subtler sensations of vibration or a sense of the body dissolving away. The experience of jhana. We have seen that the quality and intensity of deepening concentration can manifest in a variety of ways, differing greatly from one person to another. You might experience the jhana factors rapture and pleasure as blissful bodily sensations of energy, vibration, light, or sound. The feelings can be very powerful, pouring over you like a waterfall, or may only be very soft and light. Meditators sometimes judge their progress solely in terms of the presence of the jhana factors and the absence of the five hindrances. Because jhana is defined by a standard formula, they may believe there are certain milestones to be met, well-defined and common for everyone along this path. They may think they are in jhana if rapture and pleasure are strong. It is a mistake to see the jhana factors as the sole criteria for judging whether or not you have attained the first jhana. Even in the beginning stages of meditation, when concentration is just beginning to blossom, you can feel pleasure. Your mind can be more unified and less distracted. As samadhi strengthens, the jhana factors may become more pronounced, but even in jhana, how the factors present themselves is highly individual. We cannot say jhana is marked for everyone by any particular expression of rapture and pleasure. If you have a preconceived idea of what kind of or how much rapture or pleasure you are supposed to have, you may find yourself striving for that. Remember, the stages of jhana are stages of letting go, not of gaining. If you find yourself comparing and judging, try to let it go. You will suffer less and progress faster. Three essential characteristics of jhana. Jhana is a distinctive state marked by three universal qualities. These three qualities are hallmarks of all four stages of jhana. For anyone in jhana, the mind is utterly undistracted and incapable of wandering even for a moment. It is extraordinarily lucid and clear, and the meditation proceeds entirely on its own, with no sense that you are doing anything to sustain it. Whenever these three aspects are present, regardless of the experiences accompanying them, jhana has been reached. If these are not all present and fully developed, you cannot call the meditative state jhana. Unification of mind. The first quality of jhana is sustained, unbroken mindfulness. An untrained mind tends to be easily distracted, never really settled, and quick to jump from one thing to another. It is striking and a big relief when our mind first begins to quiet down in the early development of concentration. Once concentration is very strong, our minds may not wander much, perhaps only for a moment or so in the deeper stages, before we come back. Perhaps the mind does not wander at all, and there is only an impulse for the mind to start to drift or a slight agitation or instability within awareness. Once you are in jhana, all of that movement is gone. The mind cannot wander or even have an impulse to wander at all, as long as you are in that meditative state. As autumn gives way to winter, snow can turn into a slushy mixture of water and ice, thicker than liquid, before finally freezing completely. The icy water is undoubtedly freezing, but there is no mistaking slush for solid ice. If your mind can move even a slight amount, you are not in jhana. You may be close, but once in jhana, your mind will be immovable in sustained undistractedness. Though your mind in jhana cannot move from unbroken mindfulness, there remains a part of your mind that can move to incline your attention in particular directions. This is a very subtle movement. We will explore this in detail later in this chapter and in the next. Heightened clarity. The second quality universal to everyone in jhana is increased clarity of mind. Compared to ordinary states of mind, we can see how much more aware we naturally are of subtle aspects of experience when concentration is very strong. Once you have entered jhana, that clarity of awareness is heightened to a whole new level that was previously inaccessible. You may notice the genesis of thoughts. In the first jhana, thoughts do not arise in the other jhanas. The first impulse for them appearing even before breaking to the surface of consciousness. In jhana, your body and mind are tranquilized so that there may not be a lot to experience beyond the jhana factors themselves. But your perception is so clear and bright that you are keenly attuned to whatever does arise. It is like bringing a light to a darkened room. Where you previously could only make out shadows or vague forms, now you see everything in sharp detail. Self-sustaining. The third central jhana quality is a sense of self-sustaining. Not only is the mindfulness unbroken, the mind unwavering, but the process of meditation is unfolding on its own without you doing anything to make it happen or keep it going. As concentration builds, meditation starts to feel more effortless. Even in the early stages, meditation feels easier when you are settled and clear compared to the times when your mind is hazy and you cannot focus. The momentum of the concentration carries you, and there is not so much you have to do to keep the practice going. You are still putting in some amount of effort. You still incline your mind to connect with objects of meditation, but with a lighter and lighter touch. Perhaps there is only a slight turning of your attention to connect with your breathing. In jhana, the sense of having to do anything to maintain the meditation, even on the subtlest levels, is gone. As long as you are in jhana, the meditation is completely effortless and self-sustaining. These three aspects of jhana, the unbroken awareness, the heightened clarity, and the self-sustaining or effortlessness, are common hallmarks for everyone. Along with these, there may be other experiences, such as the jhana factors, which can vary greatly from one person to another. Some people may not experience much else besides the sustained clarity and a sense of calm and stillness. For others, jhana can be accompanied by very powerful lights, energies, or other blissful experiences. As you get close to jhana, it is important to distinguish between the experiences of concentration, the bliss, light, or energy, and the undistracted clarity itself. Deepening stages of samadhi and jhana are not stages of gaining new experiences, but stages of letting go. Some people become caught up in or fascinated with these dramatic experiences, but ultimately they all drop away, especially when you get to the third and fourth jhanas, leaving only the clear, bright mind. Be aware of how the jhana factors are arising for you, but mostly stay attuned and interested in the three main qualities that will help you attain and then advance through the progressive, subtler stages of jhana. How to attain jhana. Meditators will sometimes wonder, is this jhana? You can be sitting right on the doorstep and not know. You cannot know how close you are until you have made the transition and see what it looks like on the other side. Once you enter jhana, there is no longer any doubt. Once you cross the threshold, you access a degree of steadiness and self-continuation that is striking, a qualitative shift to an entirely new level of clarity, steadiness, and self-sustained presence. Maturing of right effort. Sensing they are so close to jhana, but unable to take hold of it, people can sometimes become more frustrated or impatient. Agitation can feed back onto itself, pulling you out of concentration and causing even more aggravation as remnants of clarity and calm melt away. Non-clinging is the fruit of Dharma practice, but is also the way forward itself. By remembering to meet your meditation with an experimental attitude, a willingness to stay present and learn what works and what does not, you have gained wisdom and skill. From all the times you kept sitting through worry, frustration, or pain, you have developed the capacity for patience. Kindness for ourselves, discernment, and mindfulness are all essential for attaining jhana. But these qualities are not merely tools to aid us in our journey. The wholesome qualities we have been developing to reach jhana are their own reward. They are sometimes the fruit of our practice. Embracing an attitude of the path as the goal supports us to relax and be at ease makes the quality of a liberated mind come alive for us now and offers the fastest way toward realizing jhana. If you have never played the piano, you would not expect to have any skill at it. But by just beginning, though you have no ability whatsoever, your playing will improve. The same is true in meditation. By applying yourself, doing the best you can, you move from tenuous first steps to competence and skill. Reflect on and acknowledge what you have learned. You have put in time and energy, sitting when you were inspired, and carrying on when you didn't want to, through all the ups and downs, and you are learning how to do it. Entering the first jhana. Entering jhana happens on its own. You cannot make it happen. The stages of jhana are not progressive stages of doing or gaining. They are deepening levels of letting go and simplifying the mind. We cannot force the blossoming of jhana any more than we can force a flower to open. The very act of trying is too much mental activity for the mind to settle down completely. But while we cannot force a flower to open, we can provide everything the flower needs to blossom. Similarly, there are things we can do to facilitate the process of jhana and to create the conditions necessary for the mind to drop into jhana when it is ready. Stay aware of how much effort you are making and in what direction your effort is aimed. Like the Buddha, we can learn this skill if we apply ourselves with practice. The key to doing this is not complicated. Just carry on with a simple form of connecting with your body breathing and let the process continue to unfold. Use the breath as skillful means in support of letting go. Do not try to press or force yourself to attain jhana or any other state of meditation. Pushing is counterproductive because it is too much doing, too much activity, when what we want is for the mind to settle, not do. Try to let go of your struggles and let go of clinging to pleasure. Simply attend wisely to whatever is happening moment by moment. Practicing in this way aims us toward jhana with a relaxed attitude that does not overstrive and allows the experiences of samadhi to develop organically. You still have to make some amount of effort until you are in jhana, but it becomes an ever lighter touch until finally you have let go completely as the stream of samadhi carries you. You put in the work, make the effort toward building momentum, and then let the meditation's own power engage and take off. You will know if you are striking the right balance between effort and letting go by paying attention to what happens as the momentum builds. If you are making too much effort, you may feel more agitation rather than more peace. Notice if you feel tense or tight or restless. Drop back and let go so that the momentum can take over. Shift from doing to feeling yourself being pulled in. Similarly, notice what happens when you let go too soon. See if your mind wanders or moves more. If you let go too much before you are ready, you will feel yourself lifting out of the meditation. You will not be as concentrated. If this happens, bring back the effort and intention to direct the process more. As the jhana factors strengthen, some teachers will advise letting go of the breath and shifting your attention solely to the pleasant aspect of your experience itself as your meditation object in order to bring you into jhana. However you are experiencing rapture and pleasure, connect with the pleasure itself as your meditation object. This may be helpful for some people, and you can try it, but pay attention to what happens if you do. Sometimes, letting go into the pleasant feeling can help bring us further in, while for others, staying with the breath works best. In any case, you cannot turn away from the breath and place your attention on pleasantness too soon, or else you will lift out of the samadhi. By taking your attention away from the meditation object too early and putting it on the pleasantness itself, you can feel yourself lifting out. You will not be as deeply concentrated. In this case, bring your attention back to the samadhi breath or the samadhi suffused throughout the body or whatever meditation project you may have, letting go into that experience to take you deeper. You have to stay attuned and see what works best for you. In previous chapters, I discussed how, as concentration deepens, we can head in one of two directions, either more deeply immersed in body awareness or disconnected from consciousness of our body. Stay attuned to how the process is unfolding. As long as you have a sense of being connected with your body, though it may be quite subtle, continue practicing as you have been, either more narrowly focused in the area of the breath or opened up to the whole body. This will be your doorway into jhana. If you feel like you are becoming disconnected from your body, then this is the time to intentionally turn your awareness into the body and, making as much effort as necessary but no more, suffuse the experiences of samadhi throughout your body. Let that be your doorway into jhana. Recall the simile for the first jhana. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice heaps bath powder in a metal basin and, sprinkling it gradually with water, kneads it till the moisture wets his ball of bath powder, soaks it, and pervades it inside and out, yet the ball itself does not ooze, so too a bhikkhu, monk, makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. What is the bathman doing in this simile? He is making soap. He is combining water and bath powder, mixing and kneading them together until you no longer have two separate things. You have just one thing, soap. Water and powder have unified into something new. In precisely the same way, you make the rapture and pleasure, however you experience them, born of seclusion, drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body. You are bringing them into the body. This is a very clear, precise, and accurate description of what happens. Rapture and pleasure suffused through the body is both the way into jhana and the nature of the state of the first jhana. You have been staying with the breath, and now the instructions have changed. Notice there is no mention of the breath in the definition of jhana. The breath has done its job, and now awareness has spread throughout the body. The meditator makes the rapture and pleasure drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body. You are consciously bringing it into the body if it is not happening on its own. Entry into jhana is marked by an absorption into the rapture and pleasure suffused through the body. We are immersed in it. It permeates and soaks every part of us. For some, when the mind is ready, it will drop into jhana of its own accord. Others may need to purposefully suffuse the samadhi experiences throughout the body, just as described in the simile. Stay with the process as it suffuses on its own and guide it. Suffuse it throughout the body if you need to. Stabilizing jhana. When you first touch jhana, you may only stay in it for a short time before you are lifted right out. You may not know how you got in, how to stay in, or how to find your way back. Remember patience and try your best to let go of struggle or trying to force the process. With time and experience, you will find the way to jhana more consistently. As you take your time with each jhana, you will get to know it and learn how to move in and out of it. As you begin to stabilize in jhana, you can hang out there and check out what it's like. How do you experience jhana? Is the rapture strong or light, edgy or smooth? Are there any thoughts? Notice the part of your mind that is unmoving and the part you can incline to investigate your experience. With only the barest, lightest touch, examine and get to know the surroundings. Do not be in a hurry. Without trying to get to the second jhana, spend some time noticing how things unfold. Progressing through the jhanas. We move through the jhanas either by doing nothing and letting the process unfold on its own, or by doing something and engaging in the process of letting go. For some, once the first jhana has been attained, progression happens on its own. If moving through the jhanas is going to happen on its own, you will feel yourself dropping down into deeper states. Whether the progression happens in a single setting or over the course of months, you will not have to do anything, and your mind will naturally settle, moving to the second jhana and beyond. Others may turn their minds towards simplifying and letting go to progress further. This can be a sense of letting go of the coarser experiences of the present jhana, or of leaning into the subtler experiences of the next. Directed attention. The use of directed attention may be important for some people in order to progress through the jhanas, just as it was important throughout our meditation leading up to jhana. I have been emphasizing that once in jhana, awareness is so stabilized, there is not a sense of doing anything to keep the process going. The mind is undistracted and unmoving, and because it is absorbed in a steady awareness, you cannot make mental effort in the ordinary sense. As you are carried with the unfolding progression, there is no sense of any activity on your part making it happen. But even in the still places of meditative absorption and jhana, there remains a part of the mind that can be inclined in certain directions. It sounds paradoxical that the mind is unmoving, yet there is some part that can move, that our awareness can be directed somehow. This is a subtle place in the meditation. A slight amount of knowing and directing of attention remains. The inclination of awareness is extremely delicate, but because your perception is so keen, you do not need much other than a subtle awareness. Second jhana. With a stilling of thought and examination, he enters and abides in the second jhana, which is characterized by rapture and pleasure born of concentration and accompanied by inner composure and singleness of mind without thought and examination. The stars are always above us, but are obscured by the sun's brilliance by day. Only when the sun sets do the stars reveal themselves, coming to prominence in a powerful display against the night sky. The subtler features of jhana emerge as the coarser qualities fall away. This pattern will characterize progress through each of the jhanas. The second jhana is more quiet and still than the first. The thought and examination of the first jhana have fallen away. Rapture and pleasure remain, and other qualities, inner composure and singleness of mind, begin to emerge. In the first jhana, there can be some thoughts. With the stilling of thought and examination, the verbal process of thinking settles as you enter a wordless realm. The connecting and sustaining function of thought and examination is no longer necessary and drops away. Your awareness just is connected and sustained without the necessity of any mental function to sustain it. Inner composure and singleness of mind become more prominent as we find ourselves in a quieter, simpler place. Listen to the simile for the second jhana. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below, and it had no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain, then the cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by cool water. So, too, a bhikkhu, a monk, makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Notice the shift from the first to the second jhana in the description of what happens. Just as in the first jhana, the rapture and pleasure drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body, but the image is different. To get to the first jhana, we are working and kneading like the bathman, putting in some amount of effort to suffuse the rapture and pleasure throughout the body. The precise amount of effort varies for each of us, depending on how the process unfolds on its own, but there is some sense of directing the process. Now, in the second jhana, the process of suffusing throughout the body is still happening, but it is coming from a deeper place. It feels a lot quieter. Instead of the external effort and energy of the bathman, the infusion is welling up deep from within, out of the momentum and concentration of the first jhana. Take some time and get to know what the second jhana is like.